to block their access. None of what Donald Trump alleges has been proven to be true. Nonetheless, Republicans and Republican legal challenges in key states are set to continue. Leading the effort to marshal a legal force like the one which led the party to victory in 2000 Florida recount were Jared Kushner, Donald Trump Jr., and his younger brother Eric Trump, as well as Rudy Giuliani, the former New York mayor. Beginning on Monday, Donald Trump added, "Our campaign will start prosecuting our case in a court of law to ensure election laws are fully upheld and a rightful winner is seated." So what is Biden hiding? "I will not rest until American people have the honest vote count they deserve and that democracy demands." Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka, has largely stayed quiet in the last few days. Nowhere to be seen is an army of lawyers of the size and skill Donald Trump will need. The failure to assemble a coherent legal team and to raise as much as $60 million to fund attempts to stop vote counts in some swing states and continue them in others was in many ways a reflection of previous failures among the small circle of mostly family advisors that Donald Trump has kept around him. What a campaign needs to do to staff one statewide recount, let alone multiple recounts, is overwhelming, according to Benjamin Ginsburg, a top Republican lawyer who was national counsel to George W. Bush in 2000 and 2004. In an interview with CNN, Benjamin Ginsburg said, "Bush versus Gore was one state, Florida. We put out a call and hundreds of lawyers, political operatives, and many others responded. Even with that, it taxed the party to its limits to do just one state. It is at best unproven that the Trump campaign can command the sort of infrastructure they would really need to pull this off." The legal challenge to Biden's victory was placed in the hands of Jay Sekulow, who defended the president during the Mueller investigation and the impeachment process, and Rudy Giuliani, who went to Philadelphia to publicly demand Republican operatives be granted greater oversight over the Pennsylvania vote count. Apparently, Rudy Giuliani learnt about Joe Biden's win from reporters and journalists in Philadelphia. Among experts dismissing Donald Trump's legal moves was James Baker, who led the effort for George W. Bush in Florida, which wrested the White House from Al Gore. It was reported this week that Jared Kushner was placing calls from the Trump War Room in search of his own version of James Baker, a former Chief of Staff, Treasury Secretary, and Secretary of State. Baker has backed Donald Trump, but he told the New York Times that 20 years ago, "We never said don't count the votes. That's a very hard decision to defend in a democracy." Trump advisors have reportedly raised the prospect of defeat. According to the Washington Post, some have advocated that the president should offer public remarks committing to a peaceful transfer of power. One senior Trump aide, however, said there had been no discussion of a formal concession. Some supporters in the media have begun to back away. Late on Friday, 6th of November, the Fox News host Laura Ingraham an ardent Trump loyalist, advised the president to accept defeat should it come with grace and composure. Laura Ingraham also railed at failed consultants and campaign officials who blew through hundreds of millions of dollars without the legal apparatus in place to challenge what we all knew was coming. Why aren't the best lawyers in America on television night after night explaining the president's legal claims? Ingraham asked. The New York Post also changed its tune. In October, the paper called Trump an invincible hero who survived every dirty trick the Democrats threw at him. But on Thursday, the New York Post accused Donald Trump of making an unfounded claim that political foes were trying to steal the election. Support from Republicans in Congress was notably tepid. On Friday, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said only every legal vote should be counted. Any illegal submitted ballots must not be counted. All sides must get to observe the process, and the courts are here to apply the laws and resolve disputes. As night drew in on Saturday, Donald Trump returned to Twitter. Among more baseless claims of malpractice, he bragged that he had received 71 million legal votes, the most ever for a sitting president. That much was true if the number was rounded up. Trump's challenger, however, Joe Biden, had 4 million more votes than Trump.
Outgoing US President Donald Trump made it no secret that he was on the warpath when it came to China. Not only did he spark a contentious trade war with the Chinese, but he also brazenly stated that the COVID-19 virus was Chinese-made, sparking notions of racism, which, along with his disastrous handling of the virus in the US, likely cost him his place at the White House. It's therefore strange to see a senior US Air Force commander stating that US troops in the region should prepare for conflict in the near future, echoing tones stated by Chinese President Xi Jinping during a recent visit to a military barracks in China. In spite of the ongoing election saga taking place in the US, the Americans claim that the Chinese are taking part in malicious activities around the Pacific Rim, and in particular in the South China Sea, stating that China is misaligned with international law. Yet it can be argued that the polar opposite is true, as the US seek to provoke and agitate the Chinese by sending senior representatives to Taiwan, as well as stoking the flames in the recent tensions in Hong Kong, suggesting that if anyone should be claiming foul play, it's the Chinese over the Americans. It therefore remains to be asked as to whether the Americans are more eager to start a conflict than China. With the US already embroiled in a host of conflicts around the world, could the US then be seeking to start another with its greatest rival China, not only to cement its place as a world power, but also to stem the rise of the Chinese emerging as a threat to the US hegemony?
But I can say that for sure this kind of provocative statement, they come from the United States. They don't come from China. From China, there is no, basically no statement or will to provoke a war, basically.
When Donald Trump paid a visit to India, many claimed that the partnership formed between Modi and Trump was aimed at sending a message to another regional player, namely China, and it seems that the predictions were correct. The US has also expanded its regional and global sphere of influence further, as it seems that both Germany and Australia have joined the Americans and Indians in the region by performing military exercises in the area, clearly adding another US-backed layer of provocation towards China.
There are many countries involved, but from my point of view, I will say just the countries that are, let's say, for sure in the alliance with the United States. I will mention Japan, South Korea, definitely Vietnam, India, and Australia.
Yet with the election of President-elect Joe Biden to the White House, we may see the US reverse its rhetoric towards China, as Biden attempts to pick up the pieces left behind from the Trump legacy. However, there's one very worrying factor in the equation, namely that Trump still has until the end of January before handing over power to Biden, meaning that the unstable president may still have a trick or two up his sleeve, including the temptation of testing the very massive military that he leads. But as Trump finds himself on the way out, many of those surrounding him have also distanced themselves from the outgoing president, including a vital piece of the conflict puzzle, Defense Secretary Mark Esper, who has prepared his resignation letter for Trump. But for now, it's probably safe to say that all attention has been diverted away from a conflict between the US and China as the Americans enter a transition period, and Biden waits with anticipation to tell Trump, "You're fired."
Israel is undoubtedly an opportunist regime. It once again proved that this week when it escalated demolitions of Palestinian homes as international media were focused on the presidential election in the United States. On Tuesday, the Israeli army carried out the biggest demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank for a decade. It razed to the ground the homes of nearly 80 Palestinians, mostly children, in the Bedouin village of Herbet Homsa in the Jordan Valley. The Israeli army made sure that nothing was left of the Palestinian structures, which included homes, animal shelters, and solar panels. Palestinians say they had no idea what was about to happen to their homes. The Israelis moved in without prior notice and gave them 10 minutes to evacuate before they started bulldozing. These families are now left homeless and have nowhere to go. Vehicles and tractors belonging to the Palestinians were also taken away. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya denounced the latest Israeli crime in the occupied territories. Shataya urged the international community to intervene against Israel's attempt to displace the citizens of the Bedouin village and tens of similar Palestinian communities from their homes and lands. The Palestinian premier highlighted the fact that Israel chose Tuesday night to carry out the demolition because global attention was focused on the high-profile vote in America. The demolition drew condemnation from the United Nations and the European Union. So far this year, 689 Palestinian structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The UN says the number is more than the figures in any full year since 2016. Meanwhile, the European Union has highlighted the fact that over 50 Palestinian schools are currently under the threat of Israeli demolition. The Israeli army routinely destroys Palestinian structures in the occupied territories. Anything built without hard-to-get permits, rarely issued by Israel, is at risk of demolition by the Israeli army. Demolition of Palestinian structures and expansion of Israeli settlements are unending. Israeli settlements have been mushrooming in the occupied territories over the past decades. Widespread international condemnation has failed to dissuade the regime from such actions. Pro-Palestinian activists believe even the toughest verbal denunciation do very little to stop such violations of international law. They want the United Nations, the European Union, and other organizations to use their economic leverage with Israel to force the regime to halt its illegal action.
Well, the majority of the EU's exports to the illegal Zionist entity actually come through settlements. So while the EU issues a lot of condemnation of Israel over its illegal settlements, it needs to really put its condemnation into practice by withdrawing from a lot of its economic and bilateral agreements.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the Palestinian cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. As many governments refuse to pressure the regime, Palestinians are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day bear fruit.
European countries are announcing varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced a 6 p.m. curfew for the country's restaurants and cafes, calling for national unity. He said the restrictions can be eased if the infection curve is kept under control. French President Emmanuel Macron decreed a new national lockdown lasting until at least the 1st of December. He warned that the second wave of the outbreak in the country can prove to be even deadlier than the first. In Belgium, Prime Minister Alexander De Croo expressed hope that a team of 11 million citizens would come together in following more stringent regulations. The United Kingdom has also joined the countries that have announced nationwide lockdowns for the second time.
And so now is the time to take action because there is no alternative. And from Thursday until the start of December, you must stay at home. You may only leave home for specific reasons.
Boris Johnson added that all non-essential retail stores will close down, but there would be no need for citizens to stock up.
Things are very bad in Europe at the moment. The general mass of the population has lost confidence in their government because of their mishandling, and I would say even criminal negligence surrounding COVID-19 since the beginning. China, for example, went on full lockdown on January the 23rd. For 6 weeks and is now on top of it. Normal life has returned and the economic growth for which China is well known has been restored because China had what's called a full lockdown.
The stringent measures come as the country's confirmed COVID-19 infections exceeded 1 million, with over 20,000 cases being reported daily. The economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, massive layoffs and rising unemployment levels in Europe have added to already lingering concerns about public health. The mayors of 9 cities have bypassed their national governments to write directly to the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, demanding access to the €750 billion EU recovery fund. Protesters from across the continent are calling on their governments to provide greater financial support to those hit worst by the pandemic. In Italy, a tipping point appears to be disturbingly close. Angry demonstrations erupted in Naples just over a week ago after a local curfew was imposed. The protests were followed by a civil order in Milan and Turin, where luxury stores were looted. A poll following last week's mini-riots found that over three-quarters of Italians believe there will be more violence in the streets this winter. Experts also believe it is quite likely that countries like France that witnessed unprecedented strikes and protests before the pandemic even began face serious social unrest.
The potential economic damage from the virus and from new lockdowns is, of course, very considerable. Already we've seen European economies shrink at times during this year. And several governments, including the British government, have introduced financial schemes to help companies keep people employed. So, for example, here in Britain, we've had what's called a furlough scheme, where companies are paid 80% of workers' wages while they are in fact at home, not working. But of course, that will be very, very expensive for the country, and Britain and other countries in Europe are running up huge debts and deficits, which will have to be paid off one day.
The stakes were remarkably high before the first lockdowns were imposed back in March, but they may be even higher now.
In yet another embarrassment for the US government, new evidence has come to light that a plot aimed at overthrowing the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has shown that the very highest echelons of Washington were aware of what was about to happen, as the plans appear to have been conceived in a Trump-owned complex. The apparent coup plot was instigated in the so-called Trump Doral, a golf course in Florida, where the alleged perpetrators of the act met on the green grass of the 12th fairway, planning to overthrow Nicolas Maduro while circumnavigating the bunkers of the golf course in the process. The failed coup saw dozens of people arrested by Venezuelan forces, with many of the detained being US citizens and having links to the US-backed Juan Guaido, hence proving that the US are more than certainly involved in the plot. The clear failure by the mercenaries to overthrow Maduro in the coup shows that in spite of having one of the world's largest military forces, as well as having an almost blank checkbook funded by the CIA, the Americans have a long way to go before they are able to upstage any government in South America, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world, suggesting that the US attempt to fund a coup in Venezuela is a clear failure and an embarrassment for the Americans.
Yeah, absolutely does. It's a catastrophic failure, just an utterly sort of laughable, pathetic, you know, Bay of Piglets, as it was referred to by many. Not a very terribly serious seeming coup attempt in terms of what the United States has done in the past, but a coup attempt nonetheless. Absolutely, Trump administration's fingerprints are all over this. Although officially Vice President Pence has described this lawsuit that we see now from Jordan Goudreau, who was sort of in charge of plotting this coup and signing it with would-be sort of pseudo-president Juan Guaido, who is in fact obviously not the president of any sovereign territory or country.
As with multiple lies delivered by the US and their failed foreign policy attempts, the embarrassing failure in Venezuela is yet another notch that the US can add to their miseries when trying to destabilize any nation around the world, especially a nation that's shown the ability and skill to resist, much to the shame of Washington. It seems that the US does not seem to care whether it succeeds or fails when it comes to its foreign policies, with example after example showing that failure is a part and parcel of the US statecraft that we've all seen over the last few decades. So-called intelligence leads in the past have all shown how the lies justified by the Americans and their allies have all come to no results, and have left all the decision-makers at the top very red-faced in the process, with one such example of seeing the Saddam regime in possession of weapons of mass destruction. This is clearly the best example of them all. But in spite of the clear failures demonstrated by the US and its proxies, the fact that they can continue as if nothing had happened in the first place is something that needs to be addressed. Yet is something that appears to be just another story brushed under the carpet, in spite of evidence clearly showing that the Americans were wrong in the first place. The question that now remains to be asked is whether the US are happy to live and let live when it comes to such massive failures. Or will the red mist settle in front of the eyes of the hawks in Washington, D.C., and mean that the U.S. will seek to gain revenge in the future in ever more harder and brutal ways?
Although I am generally hesitant to draw any real distinction between the foreign policy of the Democrats and the Republicans in the sense that they both sort of ultimately want similar things, which is to say, U.S. domination of the world's people and resources. There may be some differences here in terms of the presidential election in the United States. Donald Trump obviously is playing to a very far-right fringe of Venezuelans, wealthy elite Venezuelans who live in Florida. These people are not representative, of course, of any of the normal Venezuelan population, nor are they representative of the normal Florida population.
The truth of the matter is, however, that the attempted coup in Venezuela, for example, is nothing more than an easily deniable event of the past, and is something that, like many other US-backed destabilizing techniques, will remain nothing more than a story gracing the pages of Wikipedia. Hence allowing the US to continue their calamitous foreign policies, safe in the knowledge that the denial policy is always best, and that any stories that do eventually emerge will never be acted upon. A new study has shown that so far in 2020, Americans have purchased at least 17 million firearms. According to Small Arms Analytics, this is more than any other single year since records began. Gun sales across the country had already seen a surge in the spring because of the coronavirus pandemic, but they spiked even higher in the summer of widespread protests and anger over systematic racism. The demonstrations began following the police killing of an African-American, George Floyd. Small Arms Analytics says by August, the US had exceeded last year's total. By September, the US exceeded the highest total ever. It added that the number of guns sold through the end of September 2020 is not only more than last year, it's more than any full year in the last 20 years we have records for. The revelation clearly highlights the levels of unrest the United States has witnessed this year.
There's been a tremendous amount of unrest here in the United States. There has been the Black Lives Matter movement. There's killings almost every day of black people by police and by white supremacists. So there's a real sense of panic among certain parts of the population.
According to the analytics company, the previous record for estimated firearms sold in a single year was 16.6 million. That was in 2016, when Hillary Clinton ran for president against Donald Trump and endorsed a strong gun control platform. Groups that advocate for an end to gun violence say that the surge in firearm sales will only increase the level of domestic violence. According to researchers at the University of California, gun purchases from March to May, linked to the coronavirus pandemic, were also associated with a nearly 8% rise in firearm violence across the United States. That's an estimated 776 additional shooting injuries. With much more ammunition on the streets, there's more fear across the towns and cities of America. A recent report by the Department of Homeland Security says groups and individuals with white supremacist ideologies pose the deadliest terror threat to the United States. Many of these right-wing extremists are armed and have also expressed support for President Trump. The fear is that deadly chaos could ensue if the country's presidential election on Tuesday is disputed by the incumbent. The eldest son of the late civil rights leader Martin Luther King says he fears that the election will bring about another civil war. Martin Luther King III said this is down to the kind of leadership the president has provided.
Without saying it, you know, the president doesn't say that, but he says what he needs to give people comfort in feeling that it's all right for them to say that this is what's going to happen. They themselves have said we're getting prepared for the Civil War. But everybody is buying ammunition, and it's not one side, by the way. You've got Democrats and Republicans who are gunning up.
Gun owners say months of sustained demand for firearms this year has resulted in a shortage of guns and ammunition. Long queues have been seen at gun stores. The highest sales are adding millions of weapons to a nation that already has more guns than people. With increased political polarization, racial tensions, and anger at coronavirus deaths, as well as lockdown restrictions, those post-election fears are not going to disappear.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson: is being opinionated good or bad? Brothers and sisters, there are three types of people who destroy themselves. One are those who magnify their good deeds. The other are those who are forgetful of their own sins. They forget about their sins. They completely erase those sins from their memory. The third one is being opinionated. Well, the question is it really a bad thing to be opinionated? Well, guess what? It can be both. Although, based on the observation, generally it is a bad trait to have. Why is it so? Being opinionated is defined as it is characterized by conceited assertiveness and dogmatism. Generally speaking, being opinionated means unduly adhering to one's own opinion or to preconceived notions. There is a difference between being opinionated and having an opinion, right? So there's nothing wrong with having an opinion, but being opinionated, well, it's something different. The real issue is forming a conclusive opinion with less to no concrete evidence and proof. This is where the problem begins. So the lesson that we take from this talk is that do not and never rush into forming a final opinion easily. Make sure you leave room for different opinions on a topic, and this will provide you an opportunity to learn from the opinions of others and then put you in a better position to be able to form your own opinion. So it's not wrong to have an opinion, but being opinionated and ignoring everybody else's opinion is something wrong. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we're discussing a very interesting question, and that is being opinionated good or bad? Well, we said it could be both, right? There's a difference between forming an opinion or having an opinion versus being opinionated. Well, when we say that, you know, being opinionated is not good, rushing into making a final decision is not good, why is it so, right? What does being opinionated do to you? Well, being opinionated refrains you to grow academically. So if you are an opinionated person, then you do not consider anybody else's research, anybody else's opinion of any value. Well, guess what? It actually refrains your growth, your academic growth. Second one is being opinionated restricts progress, development, and innovation. Right? Now, at an individual level or at a social level, if there is a person or a society that is just opinionated, they close themselves, they restrict their progress, their development, and innovation in that society. Number three, being opinionated discourages teamwork and coordination with others. Why? Well, it's simple. You don't consider anybody's opinion to be of any value. So why would anybody have a teamwork with you? Why would you be able to coordinate with others? You can't. Last but not the least is that being opinionated causes unnecessary friction and stubbornness. How many times have we seen people who are, you know, very staunchly opinionated, and they have staunch opinions about things, right? They don't really get along with others. They cannot have a good discussion, a healthy discussion. They cannot brainstorm with anyone. Why? Because as soon as they start saying something, you know, the friction begins. And then that leads into stubbornness. At the same time, brothers and sisters, we said all these negative things, but forming a solid opinion based on concrete knowledge has been encouraged in Islam. So keep that in mind. That side note, and the lesson is, do not rush into making decisions and coming to conclusions. Mm-hmm. dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
In a series of unhinged tweets on Saturday morning, November 7th, most of which were marked by the social media company as containing information that is disputed or might be misleading about an election or other civic process, Trump lied to the world without providing a shred of evidence that massive fraud has taken place since Election Day. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by John Quayle, writer. This article is published under the heading Trump Effort to Steal Election and So National Chaos is Taking Place in Broad Daylight. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Vanquishing President Donald Trump, Democratic nominee Joe Biden was announced winner of the 2020 presidential election on Saturday, November 7th, and is now slated to become the 46th President of the United States of America. Major news outlets, including NBC News and the Associated Press, made their official projections late on Saturday morning, November 7th. Shortly before the race was called, President Donald Trump continued his brazen effort to spew misinformation as a way to steal the presidential election away from the American people, even as the results up to that point, based on a steady counting of ballots nationwide and in key states, all showed that Joe Biden was almost certainly on the verge of being the next president of the United States. In a series of unhinged tweets on Saturday morning, November 7th, most of which were marked by the social media company as containing information that is disputed or might be misleading about an election or other civic process, Trump lied to the world without providing a shred of evidence that massive fraud has taken place since Election Day, as the state election offices counted an unprecedented amount of mail-in absentee and provisional ballots cast this year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. At 10:36 a.m. Eastern Time, Trump asserted, "I won this election by a lot." There was, however, only one possible fact-based response to such a clear lie, and that would be, "No, you didn't." According to the New York Times, at the time Trump issued those tweets, Biden was leading the president in the Electoral College race by a margin of 253-214. And the national popular vote by 4,150,184. And, as was predicted almost word by word by people like Senator Bernie Sanders, who warned exactly of this kind of nightmare scenario, instead of getting ready to concede as he inched towards inevitable defeat to his Democratic rival, Trump instead wrapped himself in a thick blanket of falsehoods to claim that a huge number of ballots cast against him were fraudulent as a way to delegitimize the election and sow massive distrust and unrest among his supporters. According to the Associated Press, earlier on Saturday, November 7th, Biden was edging closer to win with a final call in Pennsylvania, all he needed to secure overall victory in the Electoral College race by 270. As AP reported early in the day, prior to a final batch of reported votes, which put him over the top, the delay in producing a verdict could be attributed to high turnout, a massive number of mail-in ballots, and slim margins between the candidates. Biden held leads in Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Georgia, putting him in a stronger position to capture the 270 Electoral College votes needed to take the White House. There was intense focus on Pennsylvania, where Biden led Trump by more than 28,000 votes, and Nevada, where Biden was up by about 22,000. The prolonged wait added to the anxiety of a nation facing historic challenges, including the surging coronavirus pandemic and deep political polarization. Meanwhile, Trump renewed his offense by making baseless claims of fraud. Bad things took place during those hours where legal transparency was viciously and crudely not allowed, stated at 8:20 a.m. Eastern Time via his Twitter account. Tractors, blocked doors, and windows were covered with thick cardboard so that observers could not see into the count rooms. Bad things happen inside. Big changes took place, he added. Not a word of this is substantiated, but that didn't stop the president from saying it to his millions of supporters. Since election night, when Trump outrageously claimed he already did win the election, Trump has refused to acknowledge the legitimate vote counting process and instead used the ensuing days. While Biden called for patience and assured Americans that every vote must be counted to deepen his conspirational proclamations, Trump's efforts, say progressive critics, are about much more than just lying and deceit, but should be seen as an outright effort to steal the election. As Esquire's Jack Holmes wrote on Friday, November 6th, the whole situation in the United States is incredibly easy to understand and clear to see. What is now happening has been coming, and it's been incredibly obvious for months. Well, years. In 2016, Trump said he would only consider the election legitimate if he won. Even when he won, he greeted the news he'd gotten shellacked in the popular vote by saying 3 million of those votes were fraudulent. 3 million! And yet, when he created an entire presidential commission to investigate, they found nothing and disbanded. Then he ransacked the institutions of democracy for 4 years, undermining the separation of powers and the independent system of justice and the free press, until this election was approaching and he once again said he'd only lose if it was rigged. The president said he would scream fraud if he lost, and now that he's losing, he's screaming fraud while providing zero count admissible evidence, continued Holmes. This isn't complicated. Trump announced on Twitter that he would hold a big press conference at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, but that event never materialized.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has congratulated U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. In a statement, Abbas said he looks forward to working with the President-elect and his administration. Palestinian officials have expressed their satisfaction with the departure of outgoing President Donald Trump and said, for them, nothing was worse than Trump's era.
We welcome the results of the American elections. Like many world states, we agreed that Trump's era was a nightmare. As President Abbas said, we are looking forward to achieve freedom, independence, justice, and dignity for our people. All previous U.S. administrations had specific commitments towards Israel, but this time we hope we can cooperate with the new administration.
Several Palestinian political groups have also expressed their satisfaction with, in the first place, the departure of President Donald Trump. The man who took several anti-Palestinian measures, including recognition of Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital in late 2017, moving the U.S. embassy there, and declaring the so-called deal of the century. This had led the Palestinian Authority to halt its political dealings with Trump's administration.
We don't expect to witness a great difference between U.S. administrations and the Israeli regime. But Trump tarnished U.S. image and harmed its interests in the region. I hope Biden can make the U.S. committed to international law. Biden and Trump differ in everything, in performance and reasoning.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was among Trump's close allies around the world, waited 12 hours to congratulate Biden, but at the same time he thanked Trump for taking U.S.-Israel ties to an unprecedented level.
For Palestinians, a change of administration in the U.S. is not a promise of change in Washington's policy toward them. However, Palestinians do hope for a gain in Donald Trump's departure, as his term in office is considered the worst even among most hostile U.S. presidents. Muraqandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Coronavirus cases among the general population are rapidly increasing in the Gaza Strip as over 200 infections are being discovered daily. The first community spread of the deadly virus was detected in late August, and over 8,000 cases have been discovered so far. Health officials have sounded the alarm over the rising figures in the densely populated enclave.
The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is high, and we are extremely worried due to the rising number. We are doing our best to deal with the situation. We are working round the clock to detect infections.
The coronavirus has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. COVID-19 has threatened the socio-economic welfare of nearly 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza as much as their health.
People here don't have access to preventive equipment because they are crash strapped. They can hardly provide food for their families.
People have been suffering from the Israeli blockade, and now the situation has only gotten worse because of the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver. Gaza's health sector is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and hospital supplies.
14 years of the inhumane Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip have taken their toll on the humanitarian, health and economic situation. The Israeli blockade has left the health system in Gaza in ruin, making it unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is fast spreading in the Gaza Strip, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
As infections continue to rise, rights groups are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the deadly coronavirus. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
On Friday, taxi drivers went on a one-day strike nationwide, calling the government's attention to the economic plight they're facing following the pandemic crisis and the connected restrictions. Unions also called two protests held in front of the economy and transport ministries, attended by thousands of taxi drivers from across the country. Drivers are demanding more support from the government as, quote, they don't have the money to pay the monthly costs of the vehicles, nor to provide for their families.
Gli aiuti ricevuti sono assolutamente insufficienti.
The subsidies we have received from the government so far are totally inadequate. 275 euros each month is not sufficient. How are we supposed to put food on the table for our families? Consider we have suffered losses in the range of 80 to 90%.
Intorno ai 3.600 euro.
Io ho ricevuto.
My income has dropped by 80%, but all expenses have remained unvaried. Insurance fees, fuel and car disinfection costs have not been reduced. Furthermore, the government is doing nothing to stop illegal cabs from going around.
A new three-tier restriction system came into force on Friday. As a result, four Italian regions, namely Calabria, Lombardy, Piedmont and Val d'Aosta, have been placed in soft lockdowns. The government has also imposed a nationwide curfew from 10 p.m. until 5 a.m., requiring all museums and galleries to shut down and all shopping centers to close on weekends.
Protests against the new anti-COVID restrictions imposed by the government have been staged in a number of cities across Italy. Some demonstrations turned violent as protesters vented their frustration and anger over how the pandemic crisis has been handled.
The virus is a moving train. Today it is necessary to slow it down, otherwise the train will knock us down. We are hopeful that these measures will be limited to several weeks.
The new restrictions imposed by the Italian government apply for about 4 weeks, until December 3. Max Civili, Rome.
On the 14th of March 2011, Bahraini security forces began a violent crackdown on protests demanding greater political participation, free and fair elections, and an end to corruption and equality for the country's suppressed Shia majority. It has now been revealed that the UK's top military officer, General Sir David Richards, was in Manama holding meetings with the country's senior military officials and the Crown Prince 5 days earlier. In the brutal crackdown, Bahrain security forces were backed by 1,000 UK-trained and equipped Saudi troops. Since then, almost all prominent human rights defenders and dissidents have been jailed, silenced, or forced into permanent exile. The main opposition party, Al-Wefaq, has been dissolved, and the country's only independent newspaper, Al-Wasat, forcibly closed down. Torture is widespread in Bahrain's prisons, especially for the purpose of extracting confessions that are used to sentence people to death. And the country has the largest number of political prisoners in relation to population.
We have interviewed people, men, women and children, who have been tortured by the regime. Children who have been snatched from the streets by armed gangs and have been then beaten and driven around the streets. One boy had his teeth knocked in. And they are forced then to inform on family members or friends or people that they know in the villages who have attended democratic protests or have attended political gatherings. Inside the prisons, people have been waterboarded. They've been beaten with truncheons on their bare bodies and on their feet. They've been hung for hours, days, and deprived of sleep. They have been anally raped with truncheons. They have been just the cruelest, most inhumane treatment.
Nonetheless, the British government continues to support the regime. When construction began on a new permanent naval base in Bahrain in 2015, then UK Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond said this.
This will give us the flexibility to respond to any emerging challenge in the Gulf, whether it's from a state actor or a non-state actor, whether it's from within the Gulf or outside the Gulf. This enhances our range. It gives Britain a permanent naval base east of Suez for the first time since 1967.
Strategic interests seem to be Westminster's priority. According to Human Rights Watch, arbitrary arrests, torture, executions and forced disappearances continue with very little interference from so-called democracies. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With the name of martyr Qasim Soleimani decorating the Persian language department at the University of Sana'a, the first graduates of the department walking down it, reviving the memory of Haj Qasim, who they carried his name as a title for their badge.
When we talked about the Persian language, it was impossible to learn it because of the international fight against it, and whoever spoke it was considered as the enemy of Islam. Today, however, we have proof to the world that we and the Iranian people are brothers, and Islam unites us.
Graduates expressed their overwhelming joy of this accomplishment, stressing that their choice name for the Soleimani badge comes at a critical time in light of American unilateralism, reaching its peak.
Martyr Soleimani is a first in the region, and his support for the Palestinian cause requires us to revive his memory by naming a badge in his name.
The ceremony came after Hassan Erlu presented his credentials to the president of the Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, as ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen. This shows the depth of the Yemeni-Iranian relations, especially with the U.S. escalating its hostile policies towards the two countries and towards the resistance axis as a whole. Erlu's predecessor left Sana'a in September 2015, and in October last year, Iran's foreign ministry said the process of sending a new ambassador was hindered by attacks on the embassy.
While some Persian Gulf Arab states' leaders rushed to normalize relations with the Zionist entity, Yemenis continued to reaffirm their support for the Palestinian cause. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Vienna pays tribute to the victims of Monday's terror attack carried out by a sympathizer of the Daesh terrorist group.
It's a really tense situation, something we never had before in Vienna. So Vienna was always a really secure place and we felt really safe and protected, and suddenly, well, out of nowhere, this comes. I'm living nearby, and hearing this was really shocking.
As the nation tries to come to grips with the terrifying shooting, news has emerged of serious mishaps in the run-up to the crime. Austria's interior minister confirmed the country did have intelligence that the gunman had traveled to Slovakia in search of ammunition in July. Apparently, a crucial tip was not followed up. Karl Nehammer admitted to official errors.
Something obviously went wrong in our communications. An independent commission of inquiry has been set up.
In Parliament, his predecessor from the right-wing FPÖ party called for the minister's resignation. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz has called for more decisive action at the EU level against what he termed political Islam. Earlier, he'd made it clear the attack should not be